Welcome. Here we are. We're back with me, Jeff Sachs, recovered mostly. Thank you for your good wishes. Next week is Purim. But Tuesday's already after Purim. So we'll have Shir. You'll be sobered up by then?
Should be. Shir with hangovers.
Oh. Does he know Marv Bifnif? Go to that.
Sure.
Anyway, like I said, I was been a little under the weather. So I thought we'd do something a little different because I started looking at a few different topics that have come up that we haven't really, you don't need the Gemaras today. We were looking at the shit.
You could have let us through, and we wouldn't have had to schlep them all the way here.
That's a little.
The car
there's a little Gemara.
This is Rex. I'm willing to come with you.
Yeah. Anyway, so there are a bunch of topics that have come up, ancillary different things that I thought we might look at, and they're centered around these passages in the Aruch HaShulchan. And I must give credit where it's due, my friend Gidon Rothstein, who's one of our teachers on Web Yeshiva, has been writing a series of things with Aruch HaShulchan. And this is where I came to this thinking. So we'll look at a couple of different topics. We'll see how long it takes us.
Someone that said Aruch HaShulchan was the halachic sefer until Mishavura came along?
Well, yes.
That's another set of rivals.
Another set of rivals. Well, yeah. There was a period where the Aruch HaShulchan was a little more preeminent. And then the Mishnah Berurah came along. And the Mishnah Berurah became, kind of more prominent. Although the Mishnah Berurah is only on Aruch Chaim. And the Aruch HaShulchan is on everything. The Aruch HaShulchan is also, shall we say, it's a little less user-friendly in the sense that it's much more, right? To make your way through the Aruch HaShulchan takes more of an effort.
It's also has more lumbus to it. I mean, you can
right, because it has, it's not just giving you the halacha l'maaseh. The Mishnah Berurah is trying to give you the halacha l'maaseh with a kind of added layer of a certain amount of documenting minhagim that, at least according to Polish Jewry, as lived by him. And then on top of that, trying to create a kind of pietistic imperative where there's the halacha, and then if you really want to get it right, if you really want to go above and beyond, these are the proper practices. The phrase in the Mishnah Berurah of Tavo Alav Bracha, right? In other words, this is the halacha, but if you want to also accomplish this, you'll receive additional blessing, additional reward. These are some of the things that the Mishnah Berurah is aiming at. It's also possible that, in other words, when we say the Mishnah Berurah beat, quote unquote, the Aruch HaShulchan, it wasn't because of book sales. In other words, the prevalence of minhagim, the prevalence of which becomes the dominant strain in halacha, is not because balabatim in America in the 1930s and 40s were buying. Most homes in America didn't own neither this set of books nor that set of books. I mean, even I'm talking about, some of your grandparents, let's say, who were frumer yidden. They didn't have, right, even though they were Shomer Shabbos and they were kept kosher and etc. But they had a question. They asked the rabbis. The question is, what influenced the poskim and then the trickle down to the rabbonim in terms of which became dominant? I think, as I recall, in Rupture and Reconstruction by Chaim Soloveitchik, there's some discussion of this particular point, but the Aruch HaShulchan.
Great biography or discussion of the Aruch HaShulchan in Sarai Amea by Yudalei Maimon, who was a Talmid,
mm-hmm.
the first right. The first star of the Torah.
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing stuff about the
yeah. I mean, in recent years, there have been a lot of scholarship and writing about the Aruch HaShulchan, some in English, some in Hebrew, about his methodology, about other things. Our friend and neighbor at Tuvia Berman, Todd Berman, is often on Shabbos morning sitting, he often has an Aruch HaShulchan that he's going through. I mean, it's a book that people should have in their libraries. Unlike your grandparents, you all have Jewish libraries. And how many people own a set of Aruch HaShulchan?
I did. I lost
it. You lost it.
No, I moved.
You moved and you left it behind.
Downsized.
So an Aruch HaShulchan is a type of book that people should. I mean, it's an investment, not just of. It's an investment of.
They have ever made a really nice edition of it?
I don't think so. I don't think it's.
I was thinking about that they should. I even and reached out to one of his years ago. Reached out to some of his descendants, Professor.
I mean, it's certainly in the public domain.
Yeah, and well, now maybe it's easier to do it, but 20 years ago, and I thought, oh, they should really come out, and they finally came out with one, and I was disappointed because it was the Aruch HaShulchan, but like corrected with the actual stock of the Mishnah Berurah, so you wouldn't possibly make the mistake of actually.
But it's been retypeset.
I mean, this particular edition, yeah, but it was like, you should, to make sure that no one would make a mistake of not following the Mishnah
Berurah. I have two sets of Mishnah Berurah at home. The classic set, you know, which was just an offset of an offset of an offset of an offset. And then at some point in the late 90s, they put out a retype, you know, when they started retype setting the classic Svarim, including with Nikudot, with Nikud, with vowels, which, you know, everybody likes vowels. So I have that the newer Mishnah Berurah, but now there have been multiple newer editions of Mishnah Berurah, but I don't know if there's been a new edition of the Aruch HaShulchan, and there's no translation of it. The Mishnah Berurah has been translated.
It was
24 volume Mishnah Berurah. What did they add to it? I mean, it was translated. The Mishnah Berurah was translated years ago by, I think, Feldheim. Has Art Scroll not put out a Art Scroll has a Mishnah Berurah? But I don't think the Aruch HaShulchan has been.
I think Rav Aaron Feldman did one of the.
Okay. So anyway, this question about the two witnesses for Kiddushin, which was a topic that's occupied us for many weeks.
Attend the rock attend.
What?
Attend the rock attend.
Well, yeah, this is going to come to our topic of being miyached the edim, and no, but just the whole idea of edim. So you remember we mentioned this already. The very first shiur that we had, Adam. When did we start learning kiddushin?
Just over a year.
Just over a year. It's a long time already. That the edut of kiddushin is what's called edut lekiyum hadavar. It's not testimony in the sense of, you know, you were walking by and you saw Reuven kill Shimon, and now you are the bearer of testimony, and you go into court, and based upon what you report and what at least one other witness would report, we can get at the truth. No. The edut of witnesses for kiddushin creates the kiddushin. It's a necessary element of having kiddushin. In other words, kiddushin can be accomplished with kesef, shtar, and bia. Our universal custom is we do it with something of monetary worth, and the universal custom is even to do it with a gold ring. You'll tell me that there's somebody did it some other way, vakasha. But every one of us got married in that way. And you have a chuppah, and you have a rabbi, and you have a ketubah, and you have little hot dogs wrapped in blankets, and everything you needed for a wedding. But without the witnesses, it's a meaningless halachic act. The presence of this giving of the ring for the sake of kiddushin, in the presence of the witnesses, is what creates the kedushin. That's what's called the kiyum davar. And without it, the kedushin doesn't work.
Do the edim have to be, if you like, positive edim? They're not just people walking past who happen to see it.
So that's this question of like what how much Eidut is Eidut. We're going to, Sharon, that's the exact question we're coming to. So if a man and a woman come to court and they say, we are legally married. Remember when you came on Aliyah, you had to prove you were married, right? That's not Kiddushin, right? That's for the purposes of the bureaucracy of the state of Israel. You have to prove that you were Jewishly married. But let's say a man and a woman come to Bet Din and say, we are legally wed. Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. We are halachically married. It's from the Oval Office. We are legally married. There was Kesef Kiddushin. And this guy here, he was our witness. And you're a kosher witness. And you say, yes, I saw it with my own two eyes. What do we have here?
Nothing.
Because? Because there were no two witnesses. Why are they not married? Not because we don't believe them. They're both completely believable. What? Maybe they even had a video. What? And maybe there are 100 people, all of whom happen to be posseledim. Because 50 of them are her brother and 50 of them are his sister. It was a big family. But there was no Eidus.
So what's the effect of that?
What?
There we go. In other words, let's say these people want to marry somebody else. The better thing wouldn't have to do it in time to be a guest.
Would they? Or wouldn't they?
Yes, because this is something new in the air, you know.
Is there? Well, let's see. So look at Sif Yud Zayin. This is the Aruch HaShulchan and Evan HaEzer Simin Membet. Now, by the way, this is a perfect example. The Shulchan Aruch here, in this Simin, in the Shulchan Aruch, which is about Eidut and Kiyum HaDavar, the Shulchan Aruch has five short Si'ifim, five short halachot. Most of them are not more than a line or two. On each of them, you have quite expansive commentary by the Ramo, right? By the Ashkenazi partner in the Shulchan Aruch. But the Shulchan Aruch itself, it's about five or ten sentences. The Aruch HaShulchan has 41 paragraph length si'ifim. Right? You see the expansive nature of what he's doing. What? I'm sorry, 51. Damn it. I didn't do that on purpose, but I said that in my head I said Nun Aleph. I explained yesterday how this like little this is glitch on that particular piece of the silicon. So in here in Sif Yud Zayin, the Aruch HaShulchan explains why they should not be legally wed. Veli nira de Rabbeinu Haramo on this here. Ba'omra kadshina o dibru trila al iske kiddushin shnit ba'er de bizarak la kiddushin af shemiyad zarkatam mikol makom have kiddushin. The Shulchan Aruch and the Rabbah had described this case where somebody throws Kesef Kiddushin at the woman, and she immediately, you know, like hot potato, right? Yeah. Throws it back. Like he throws it into her pocket. She's wearing one of those, you know, skirts with the pocket. He throws it into her pocket, which is an act of reception. But she throws it back. But there are people that are witness to this. But since she's on record as having wanted to marry him. Let's say they were already engaged. That's the case we were talking about 2 weeks ago. They were already engaged. They were already Like, it's not like a stranger. Like a stranger goes up to a woman and throws money, you know, into her basket, into her shopping cart, and says, "Hariat mikudeshetli." It doesn't matter if there's 1,000 edim there. Like, there's no kiddushin there because she doesn't want to. She doesn't know the guy. She doesn't want. There was no indication that that she accepted it willingly. That's, by the way, that's why we have this minhag that the woman sticks out her index finger. That the ring goes, even though it doesn't fit. The ring goes on the index finger because that's a kind of like sign of like, you know, yes, I really want this, right? Yes, I'm doing this. I'm accepting this willingly and gladly and out of my own free will. Is your hand up? So the Aruch HaShulchan says, that the Torah, I'll summarize what he says here, that the Torah uses the word davar. When does it say davar? So it's one of those funny things that we learn one thing from another, that we learn a lot about marriage from divorce, right? So in the context of divorce, the Torah uses this phrase ervat davar. The husband finds something objectionable, untoward. What would be a better way to?
That's a great word.
Yeah, untoward. Yeah, well, not it. Yeah, yeah. In Jane Eyre novels, maybe. Yeah, and there is something migune, something objectionable about her. And then elsewhere, the idea that al pi shnei edim. Yakum davar. So he says the Chazal wanted to like make a deal out of this word davar, right? That a davar is something, a matter, a significant matter of ishut, of marital status, right? Comes about through testimony. And just like you need witnesses for a divorce, you need witnesses for a marriage. And even though financial transactions happen all the time without witnesses. Right? In other words, for a financial transaction, you don't need a witness. Has anybody made a financial transaction today? I presume we all did. Right? You go into the makolot, you buy a lachmaniyah. It's a financial transaction. You don't need witnesses for it. And everybody understands that it was a valid halachic legal transaction. I gave money, I got my lachmaniyah. Or you gave money, you got a car. You gave money, you got property, right? But you don't need witnesses. Even though sometimes for certain sales we have a shtar, and the shtar has signatures on it, right? But for most financial transactions, you don't need witnesses. But when the transaction constitutes a matter, a davar, that impinges on other relationships. That's what marriage is. Now, remember, I think we mentioned this also in the very first shiur, the very strange Birkat Erusin. Remember, I mentioned this idea. I mean, I've come back to this more than once, right? If you were tasked with writing Birkat Erusin, you would probably wax romantic at love and marriage and horse and carriage and children and family and who knows what.
Yes.
Marriage is what brings us together today, right? Yeah, right. But what is the Birkat there? What?
I knew a couple who the Sadr Kedusha started with that line.
Marriage. I was Masadr Kedusha at my sister's wedding. Which, you know, leads to the awkward phrase saying, yes, I'm marrying my sister. I was beside a condition at my sister's wedding and she was convinced I was going to start off with that line. She was petrified of it. But instead, I started off with, I thought this day would never come. I said, that our parents would stand me up in front of all our dearly beloved, put a microphone in my hand, and allow me to say a few words about my sister. So So that's the Birkat Erusin. Birkat Erusin is about erva. It's about a rayot. Asar lano et hanesuot v'hitir lano et hanesuot lano al yedei kiddushin. So what does this mean? It means like when you get married, when you marry a woman, right? What's happening the minute that happens under the chuppah? Every other man is now forbidden to be with her. And her sisters and her mother are now forbidden to, like, there's this whole kind of like web of relationships, like dominoes start toppling with this hariyot. It's not so romantic, but that's the reality. So when you have a transaction, right? Kesef Kiddushin, that impinges on other people, so that is a higher level of halachic event. It creates a halachic reality of greater complexity, and that requires edim, right? So
therefore, they like the Kiddush HaChodesh have a similar type thing because it affects other people.
Kiddush HaChodesh. Why? Say, explain.
No, I'm saying it's not like you're saying when you have the effect of affecting people, when you do the Kiddush HaChodesh, determining when the Chag is going to be, when the thing. So
yeah, maybe. In other words, that might be for a related, a similar but not identical reason, Kiddush HaChodesh. Because after all, we know those are the Gemaras in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, that even though the Chachamim knew with certainty, because they had all the astronomical, right?
Well, okay.
No, but that's the point. In other words, that even there they knew with certainty when the new moon appears, right? It doesn't matter. That's the famous Gemara of Yoshua and Rabbi Gamliel, right? That we know when the moon is, right? This ceremony of two witnesses coming and saying they saw it, right? So if it was cloudy, if it was rainy, like why should that affect the reality of astronomy? Whether or not it's cloudy down here on Earth does not affect what's happening in the heavens, right? We know precisely when the new moon appears, assuming we could see it. So the
reality of astronomy is irrelevant.
So the reality of astronomy is irrelevant. The reality that Reuven and Leah stood under a chuppah with only one good witness means it's irrelevant. Are they married? Like, did they intend to get married? Yes. Did he give her a ring? Yes. Was it Shava Pruta? Yes. Was it everything? But what was missing? The necessary element, likayem et hadavar, right? To create the halachic reality, right? In which the fabric of existence is changed. Maybe that's what it is. You change the fabric of existence. When I buy a lachmaniyah, I'm not changing the fabric of resistance, right? I'm just transferring it from you to me. But it's still the same lachmaniyah. But when you're Makadesh Isha, you change the fabric of existence, right? You go from being two people to being one person, which is, and there you can be romantic because that really is magical. And Kiddush HaChodesh, the same thing. Kiddush HaChodesh means, say again?
This is
Cain. Right, and it's not like we delay it forever. It's either Rosh Chodesh is going to be tomorrow or the next day. Yeah, but, and a chenami. But ultimately, that's mitztaber, right? Let's say we had not established a parallel history in which Hillel Hasheni does not establish a set calendar, but yet we are unable to be Mekadesh the Chodesh. So what would happen? Where would we be now? We would be every month would have 30 days.
And you would be off.
And we would be like our neighbors, sometimes having Ramadan in the summer. Sometimes it's better to have Ramadan in January than it is to have it in August. Because the days are shorter. Right? But can you imagine you understand why they're so murderous. Imagine fasting. You know what happened? You know what happened if Jews had a fast for 30 days?
Right? Wouldn't you say that?
You think? You haven't been to my house on a fast day. But, you know, fast days are about tshuva, about correcting yourself. So there's nothing like the litmus test of that is how people act you know, when you're trying to sit down to eat after the fast.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No tolerance for hunger.
Yeah, so people get kvetchy. Jews get kvetchy. Jews don't like to be hungry. So what do I always say on that? What do I say on the tours in the summer? It's bring snacks, because nobody wants to be traveling on a bus with 30 kvetchy old Jews. So yes, okay, good. So this is why you need the Eidus, because the Eidut of two changes the fabric of reality for certain things. For things that are reality changing, then you need two Eidim. That's Kiddush HaChodesh, good example. It's marriage. Perhaps it's other things as well. What would be other examples?
Divorce, murder.
A divorce. No, but I'm not sure that murder is the same. Right? In other words, Reuven kills Shimon. Shimon's dead. That we know. Right? It's just a question of, can the court impose a certain punishment on Reuven? Right? Which has great consequence if you're Reuven. But it's not changing the fabric of reality. Right? It's not like, right?
Reality was already changed for the murder. The murder
right,
changed.
Right.
The murder changed.
But not the witness.
No, even, yeah. And others, obviously, it's like we'd have to more carefully define this term, what I mean by reality changing.
Well, seems,
but everything is reality changing. I mean, even the Lachmaniah being sold to me in the store is reality changing.
Well, no,
in some way,
but it's, I think what you're getting at is that it's about a reality that if you didn't have this halachic act, nothing would happen at all. There is no,
yeah.
I mean, merit, we can talk about merit. You gave examples of the ring and the but that actually isn't, that's only because those are the things we associate with marriage. There's nothing inherent about those things that make a marriage or not. And just like there's no, so you when you have an actual, you know, if you took Lachmaniah, you, someone, you know, kill someone, whatever, those things happen. You didn't need a halakhic.
Correct. It's just the court doing a birur to determine, to get at can we establish the facts of the truth, but that's not what it is in that. Those are all those Mishnayot and the Gemaras and Rosh Hashanah. The court knew better than anybody else what was the astronomical reality. But until Shmerel and Yankel show up saying, I saw the moon in this part of the sky facing this way, it looked like that, it was this time, it was that high above the, right? And until you have that, all of the reality of the world, it happens that I'm teaching Isha Halacha right now. Many years ago, we learned...
Not that many.
Yeah.
So we learned Isha Emunah. We learned Lonely Man of Faith. How long ago was that?
That was 5 years ago.
It was before COVID.
It was 5 and a half. It was 2018.
Maybe one day we should... years ago, we took a break from the Gemara and we learned the Rav's Lonely Man of Faith. Maybe sometime we should take a break and do... Who's really?
The new version, the new edition comes out. We have to see in honor of the new edition.
Yeah, the new edition's the same though. In other words, the text is the.
It has a great index.
They have a great index. It's true, but I can send you the index. There's a new edition. There's a new edition of the Halachic Man, but the text of the essay itself is identical. It's just a photo offset. And then Lawrence Kaplan, who had translated it, added an index, which I had prepared, and an introduction. And probably the most useful is a philosophical glossary, a glossary of all the philosophical terms that the Rav uses.
Also not used. Soft cover, right? The new version?
It's in a hard cover, I presume that.
The only soft cover, right?
They have a soft cover edition also.
The original one was only... soft cover, I think. There was a hardcover edition of it.
It was originally hardcover, yeah.
I've never seen.
I have two questions.
Yep.
Not relevant, I don't. But regarding the sentence that we just read, does that imply she can't change her mind?
Well, and it depends on how we determine like what this act of receiving the Kiddushin was. But if she receives the Kiddushin, so then, I mean, you can't...
But she went back. Threw it straight back at him as quick as she could.
Right. So there it's a question of how do we determine it? Did she accept it and had she wanted to get married? It's a separate case. We won't go into that. But it's related to what the Gemara that we learned 2 weeks ago about what do we presume. That was the Gemara. Remember, the guy like grabs the thing and gives it to her. He steals it from her and he gives it back to her. So we say, well, if she wanted to get married, right? So that's, you know, there's reason to think that.
So there's some gray in there, at least. It's not.
Yeah.
The other question is, I don't know what made you think of it, but there's one form of marriage that doesn't have any witnesses.
One. In other words, there are three ways to get married. Universally, we do it with kesef, something, a monetary gold ring. Shtar. What's a shtar? Shtar is not the ketubah. People sometimes confuse us. The shtar has nothing to do with the ketubah. The ketubah is a separate document that says, that lays out the husband's obligations. It's a rabbinic enactment that says when you get married, you have to, in writing, accept the responsibilities of marriage. But that, when we say that Haisha nikneit bekesef shtar or bia, with money or a document, the document we're talking about is not the ketubah. Kesef, kedushe shtar, is you write out a thing that says, hare at mekudeshet li b'shtar zu, and you have two edim sign it. Right? Or maybe it's phrased as, you know, Ruvain is...
But we don't do shtar.
Today we don't do shtar.
We do just
kesef. Yeah. I mean, you want to tell me that somebody... Yeah. I'm sure we can find some case of somebody that was mekadesh with a shtar. But it's just... I mean, I don't...
The yichud is from a
sorinah. What?
Yishin is just learning.
I can't hear you. She accepts the shtar. Right? It's the exact opposite of get. If you've ever seen a get, what's the get? The get is a shtar that severs the marriage. The shtar is written. It has edim. It has to be written a particular way. And then the act of passing the shtar from the husband to the wife, or from his shaliach to her shaliach, and her accepting it in her hands, right, in front of witnesses, that act is what severs the marriage. So you can, just like you can sever a marriage with a document, with a legal document, you can initiate with a legal, but this is not the ketubah. The ketubah does not, if a man gives a woman a ketubah without doing kiddushin, it's meaningless, right? It has no meaning, right? It's outside of the context of kiddushin proper. So the shtar would say, you're married to me, kedat Moshe of Israel, and he gives it to her, and with her accepting it the same way she would have accepted a ring, they, in front of witnesses, they are married. Now,
without the money, is the ketubah alone will do it?
Yes.
I mean, the document alone will do it.
The document alone would do it. It's completely parallel to kesef, but it's a different way of doing it. Now, again, it's not very romantic, and she can't wear it. But it's not the ketubah. The ketubah is an insurance policy, right? This is not the ketubah, right? She can't wear it on her finger, right? She can't bequeath it to her daughters.
There's money.
Maybe, right. So if he gave her like, you know, $100 bill or a $1 bill, right? It's not so romantic, but it would do the trick.
Bia
already in the times of the Gemara is not just frowned upon, but is really censored, right? The Gemara says, Rav Mangid Aman de Mekadesh Bebia. Somebody that would initiate kedushin through the marital sexual act, Rav thought that you should get lashes. But everybody agrees that it does create kedushin. But not every act of, I can't say premarital sex, because this is, what would be the word for it? It's the most marital sex. It's the sexual relations which initiate, which create the marriage. Well, first of all, it has to be done l'shem kiddushin, right? And although obviously the witnesses are not in the room, the witnesses, now this is not, by the way, this is not parallel to our yichud, right? But it would have been, you understand why Chazal thought this was not proper, it would have been husband and wife go together into the bridal chamber, and the witnesses witness them going in. Right. That they're going in for the purposes of initiating kiddushin through the sexual act. And then they come out, and they read the ketubah, and they say the sheva brachos, and it's rather strange, right? So already in the times of the Gemara, this practice was, to the best of my knowledge, universally you know, condemned and put out to pasture, right? It was not used. But enachinami, if there were kedushin with beer with sex through sexual relations, it would require witnesses on the outside.
The witnesses, but unlike the witnesses, the example you gave of witnesses for kesef, let's say, we definitely say now that, I mean, the people who were not religious, I don't know wherever they lived, and you know, Soviet Union, America, right, and they didn't have a kosher wedding, but if they were married and there was, you know, they had kids, I don't know, their evidence they had, then we don't require the witnesses to determine that those people were married.
Say that again.
If there's a couple who didn't have a kosher wedding, they just got married. They got witnesses. They didn't do Lashem Kiddushin because they didn't know what Lashem Kiddushin was.
Yeah.
But they were married.
They had a non-halachic Jewish wedding.
And
not a justice of the peace.
Whatever it is. It could be a justice of the peace. It doesn't make a difference. But whatever it was, if they consider themselves, they think they're married. And they've been acting like they're married. And they have kids or whatever it is. Whatever the, you know, and then, so presumably the beer is the thing that makes it a wedding. You know, you they need to get.
Not necessarily.
Well, and if you want to find a way to have another people get, but if they would
tell these people to get to have a get, but you're all aware of Rav Moshe's very well known tshuva. Rav Moshe, and it shows, by the way, like, you know, how you have to read deeper than the surface. In the Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe, who was no fan of Reform and conservative Jews, there's just no way around that. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He was no fan of Reform and conservative Judaism. He had great affection and love for all Jews. And he thought that the halakha, as it was developing or was being undermined in those movements in the United States in the mid-20th century, were doing great damage. So what do? You have these people that are getting married, you know, Reform conservative ceremonies, which were, you know, back then probably much closer to the halakhic norms than they are today, but we're still not completely halachically legitimate. Those people get divorced, and they certainly do not have a get. Sometimes they don't have a get at all, and sometimes they certainly don't have a get with all of the halachic requirements. And then she goes and gets remarried. Those children are mamzerim. This is, Years ago, for a couple of years, I used to attend Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Shiurim in Gruss. And he once made reference to this tshuva of Rav Moshe. And he said, I think I remember this correctly, he said, before Rav Moshe, the situation was a calamity. After Rav Moshe, it's a catastrophe. And then the Shiur went on and he was saying something, and I turned to the fellow next to him. It was like a half hour later. I turned to the fellow next to him and I said, like, what did he say? Like, I didn't catch that. I didn't, like, what did he say? What did he mean? And the guy said, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what's worse, a calamity or a catastrophe. So Rav Moshe said that since the Kiddushin were not Kiddushin proper and Mistama, the Edim weren't Kosher Edim, so they were never married. So that when they got divorced and she got remarried and had children with another man, the children aren't mamzerim, which of course is hatzalos nefashos. It saves their lives, these poor children, right, who otherwise would be condemned to the halachic realities of mamzerut.
But certainly that wasn't the only. I mean, Rav Moshe was known for taking these kinds of approaches. I know there's like a famous thing about a kohen who was married to somebody who wasn't allowed to, and Rav Moshe said, "You have no proof you're a kohen."
Yeah.
The same story came to the Rav. And the Rav was like, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do.
Right? Yeah, but that's why the Rav didn't paskin trials.
No, he paskin in that case.
In Boston, maybe he would, but he would tell people, go to Rav Moshe. Right? So and Achinami. It's like, so if the Rav did paskin shaila, he didn't like to do it. Right? But Rav Moshe had that responsibility. He felt that responsibility. Now, it doesn't mean you have a magic solution for every situation. Right? Sometimes you're up against the wall and you have no mechanism by which to...
Aren't there halachic ramifications of saying that a couple who thinks they're married aren't married? So even if it might make divorce more complicated, but doesn't it? If you're not like,
look, people don't ask questions, right? We don't have to go around saying to people in the supermarket, you know, you're not really married. It's adult, right? But in other words, when something becomes a practical issue of like figuring out like how do these children that they're not mamzerim, or how can this couple who's already married, this woman, this woman who had previously been married is now married to a Kohen, and they're not going to get unmarried. And, you know, so like that's what poskim do. Poskim deal with the messy realities of the bidyevid, right? Halachists deal with the pristine theoretical. It's easy to be machmir in the pristine theoretical. So anyway, that's in answer to your question. So what about a couple that gets married without witnesses? Well, they didn't know, or they, who knows, right? Right? They thought like you get married and you know, a lot of people don't know things. They call the rabbi, right? One of two phone calls. Rabbi, I want to get married. And rabbi, my father died. Right? So they figure the rabbi, you know, just like, and maybe like, you know, they call them moil. Thank God people are still, at least in some places, careful. Right? You have a baby, you know, a Jewish baby needs a bris milah. You know, how much of the halachos of bris milah do the parents need to know? They need to know one halacha, the phone number of the moil, right? Who tells you, if he was born on Tuesday afternoon, the bris will be next Tuesday morning. Bring bagels and lox. Right? How much do the parents need to know about the halachos of bris milah? Right? Everybody closes their eyes anyway. So you say, Rabbi, we're getting married, or our daughter's getting married. Can you officiate? And what's important is that in the state of New York, he's licensed to sign the certificate. Right? What are they? I mean, at the catering hall, there's a chuppah. Somebody tells me you have to bring a ring. If the rabbi's careful, he'll make sure that the groom paid for the ring himself. And the rabbi will very often bring the edim himself. Sometimes it's the cantor and one other guy from shul. Right?
Any reason the rabbi himself couldn't be there?
So can the Masada Kedushin be one of the...
Is that like one of the things?
So it's discussed in the poskim. You were Masada Kedushin?
No, Rabbi Lapin was...
You're Masada Kedushin and... So there's some poskim that don't like that very much, and no doubt Rabbi Lapin is aware of that and made his determination. There's some poskim that don't like the idea that the Masada Kedushin...
You are married.
That the Masada Kedushin should also serve as one of the Edim. And it's not typically done. It's not typically done. But Bidyevit, it certainly works, assuming he's a kosher Ed. Right? How could a Masada Kedushin not be a kosher Ed? Yeah, the Masada Kedushin should be the father of the bride. Right? The brother of the bride, father of the bride, right? But assuming that the Masada Kedushin is a kosher aid, certainly it works, but it's not typically done. If the Masada Kedushin takes payment, there are poskim that say he can't be an aid because then he's a nogeya bedavar. Because if it turned out something went wrong, right, he'd have to give back the money because he didn't do the job. But this is not something that would interfere with the thing. So since the edus is, let's say, indispensable for the creation of the marriage, the couple has to know that there are witnesses. Right? In other words, like, you know, the couple's there and there's people standing around. There's also the photographer and there's also the who knows what. So like, does the Masada Kedushin have to explain to this unknowledgeable couple, these two guys here, they're the witnesses. And they're witnessing the act creates the reality. So the Beit Shmuel, there are two important commentaries on Ibn Ezer. There's the Beit Shmuel who lived in Furth, you know, in Bavaria. And he lived in all the great commentaries, that first generation of great commentaries. The Shach and the Taz are most well known in Yeridea. And the Beit Shmuel and the Chelkat Mechokek are in Ibn Ezer. They all live, you know, let's say 100, you know, 70 to 100 years after the Shulchan Aruch is written. And the Chelkat Mechokek on Ibn Ezer is Rav Moshe Lima, who at one point becomes the Rav of Brisk. He was a Polish Rav, but then he goes to Lithuania, and he becomes the Rav of Brisk long before the Soloveitchiks get their hands on it. So the Beit Shmuel says that a couple says we did everything you had to do, ring and chuppah and etc., but there were no witnesses. The case we talked about a few minutes ago. Not even one kosher witness. But then along come two guys and say, we happened to be there. We saw the whole, you ever see sometimes they have a chuppah in the, we got married in the churva. When the churva was still charev. If you ever come to our house, it's a beautiful picture. Remember when the churva in the old city was just that arch and it had the bima? I mean, that bima is still the bima that's there in the churva. We got married there in the old city on the bima in the open air churva. But if you look at our wedding pictures, we had however many guests at our wedding, but there were twice as many tourists, right? Because you come to the old city, there were all these Japanese tourists with the Kova Temple and their Nikon cameras and, right? And they were all, you remember that there was that balcony above in the Churva, you could look down into the thing, right? So there were tourists all over them because it was just like an open air chuppah. So there were all these tourists there. You know, you see a wedding in Od Yishama Barei Yehuda, right? It was really lovely. We went dancing through the old city. It was really something special. You can watch the video on YouTube. Sure. Look up Sax Goldstein wedding. It was really mashu. In those days, I knew how to like organize things. So let's say we forgot to have them. But there were a lot of people that just happened to be there, not just our guests. So a couple says, oh, we had a wedding, but we didn't have Edim. And along come two guys who happen to be kosher Edim and say, ah, but we were there. Right? Meaning there was no Yichud Edim. They weren't appointed as Edim. They just happened to be. When they're witnesses to a theft or to a murder, they're not appointed as witnesses. How do they become the witnesses? They just happen to be there. So the same thing here.
But they have to have seen certain parts of...
They saw the whole thing. They saw the ring. They saw Harriet Mekudeshetli. So what do we say? Would we consider them married or not? Why? So the Beit Shmuel says that they are not to be considered married. But the Chelkat Mechokek, his rival on the page, they're both printed there on the page of the Shulchan Aruch, the Chelkat Mechokek disagrees.
You're okay.
Right? And he said, well, who's okay?
Stop.
Oh. Because he says it depends upon the intention. Do we assume if they're doing it without witnesses, they're really intending to be halachically married? I mean, you can say Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael with all types of, in other words, if two people that are forbidden to be married to each other, if a brother and sister stand under the chuppah with kosher Eden, and he says, Hariat Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, it still doesn't mean anything. Seder, but without witnesses, without them knowing there were witnesses, could they have possibly thought, here we're talking about knowledgeable people, without witnesses, could they have possibly thought that it was Kedat Moshe of Yisrael? No. So their intention, what was their intention? Was their intention to be halachically married? No. Why? Because they knew b'mikre, by accident there was
the Beit Shmuel.
This is the Beit Shmuel. By accident, it happened. They tried to do it right, but that doesn't matter because we're careful. We're concerned about their intent. That's what the declaration of Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael is. It's a statement of kavana, of intention, right?
So
here you're making a mockery of it.
No, in that case, but not in the case where the people were getting married, Kedat Moshe.
But they weren't, because when they said Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, They thought they were getting married without Eidim, which is a halachically meaningless act. Ah, by coincidence, there were witnesses to the matter, but the Chatan and Kala did not. So this is a machlok. So the Beit Shmuel says, it's me. The Chalka Mechokek says, no. After all, they did the act and there were witnesses. And maybe it's not the way you should do it.
So what would the Beit Shmuel say if they had witnesses, but suddenly they weren't kosher witnesses? They were gamblers and pigeon raisers or whatever. Oh. So then they really thought there was legit.
So the Chalkat Mechokek says, if the couple, in normal case, couple has witnesses, right? But it turns out that the witnesses are related, or they're puzzled for some other reason. But there were drive-by witnesses, meaning the people that we appointed as witnesses are no good. But there were not only were there drive-by witnesses, there was 100 other people in the room. So what would we say? Wouldn't that be the same machloket? Wouldn't the Beit Shmuel say what?
That would be okay because they knew. They knew they were. There's no question they were trying to be get married. If they had witnesses, they didn't realize that they were. I mean, if he said, "Look, you know, you're my brother or whatever," but like if they didn't know, then they didn't know.
Yep.
Problem here is that there's a mechanism involved. The mechanism has certain requirements. If those requirements are not fulfilled, the mechanism doesn't work.
Correct. So now this. Now this is connected to, I guess, next week. Maybe we'll continue with this next week because it comes back to this question of the Yehud Eidim, of appointing these witnesses, these two men as the witnesses to the exclusion of all others.
But then you're making a mistake because if you do that, then you're exploiting these witnesses, and then it turns out you didn't know that one of them was possible, and then you're stuck.
Okay, so we'll come back to this next week. So either hold on to these sheets or pass them back to me, and we'll look at them again next week. A Purim Sameach to everyone.
What's on the sheets?
The sheets are what you're seeing on the screen.
Oh, that's fine then. That's okay. I've got a copy here anyway, so that's fine.
The people at home see it on the screen.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Purim Sameach.
Purim Sameach.
Thank you.
Conservative rabbi. No.